And now, a trip to the not-so-distant future, where print is dying and words can vanish. Elena Graydon has written an intellectual thriller called The Word Exchange. It begins like this.
On a very cold and lonely Friday last November, my father disappeared from the dictionary. And not only from the big glass building on Broadway where its offices were housed. On that night, my father, Douglas Samuel Johnson, chief editor of the North American Dictionary of the English Language, slipped from the actual artifact he'd helped compose. That was before the dictionary died, letters expiring on the page, before the virus, before our language dissolved like so much melting snow.
Elena, your book starts with such an ingenious premise. Printed books have disappeared, language itself is endangered, and words have been monetized. Everyone now communicates with devices called memes, which are sort of like smartphones on steroids but networked into your brain?
Exactly. So the book is set a few years in the future. People have become even more dependent on their devices than, say, I am on my iPhone, and that's how they access language. And the meme really is sort of the next generation of the kind of devices that we all use now, and sort of similar in a lot of ways to the iPhone that I depend on so heavily myself. And it kind of anticipates our wants and needs using sophisticated algorithms. And also some users have gotten an optional microchip implanted in their brains. And that's what makes it possible, yeah, for language to be disrupted.
Well, so this is a futuristic noir thriller. So, of course, there is an evil corporation. And in this case, some tech moguls have figured out, as you said, how to monetize words. Explain, how does this work?
So because people have become even more dependent on these devices, they've actually sort of yielded more and more of the functionalities that we maybe once thought of as fundamental to our humanity. Decision-making, creating and interpreting things, and even using language. And they've started to forget some kind of obscure words. Initially, they forget things that maybe they just don't use that regularly or don't come across, like paradox or cynical. But their device gives them the option to download the definition from this vast online database, which is called The Word Exchange, the same title of my book. And so for a small fee, I think 2 cents at the beginning of the book, they can get just the flash of a little definition and they can continue on with their conversation or reading their email or whatever it was that they were doing. And the developers of this device are in fact the same developers who own this vast database of language. And so they decided that maybe they would, you know, exploit that memory and language loss a little bit in this way.
This is such a brilliant, evil idea. It was a little scary to read. I mean, when you thought about corporations buying and then selling the rights to words, did you think, no way, that's too far-fetched? Or did you think, oh, yeah, that could happen?
Well, you know, I obviously, in many ways, this book is meant to be a little bit fantastical. And by setting it in the future, I was interested in maybe shining a bit of a light on the present. So now there are huge conglomerates that have consolidated holdings of lots of things, music, film, you know, judicial records, maybe things that we sort of didn't ever imagine being consolidated in those ways. And yet, you know, that's become a reality. And I was sort of interested in thinking about applying that process to language and looking at what might happen if, you know, an outside force were to determine for us what words we had access to, what information we had access to.
I'm curious, are you the kind of person who reads dictionaries for fun?
I do, yeah. So, I mean, there are a lot of unusual words in my book, and partly the reason for that is that the characters are lexicographers, so they come across words that other people don't encounter. And then part of the reason for that is that over the course of the book, some of the characters catch this virus, which they refer to as word flu, and so their language actually devolves over the course of the book.
That is one of the scariest parts of the book, this language plague. Can you explain more about it?
Sure. So because the devices are hooked into people's physiology, it makes it possible for there to be a virus that in many ways mimics a computer virus, and it's referred to as word flu because it garbles people's speech and language.
Garbles it how?
They'll think of a word that is really not exactly the word that they intended to use, or they'll just sort of flip-flop letters within a word in a way that makes it really difficult for them to communicate.
And like a virus, it's...
Exactly. It's communicable.
Right? It's communicable, and also it's kind of seeding ordinary accepted language with these nonsense words that will appear.
Exactly.
So it gets harder and harder to tell what's a real word and what isn't.
You know, I wanted to use language as its own tool for demonstrating what the significance of its loss would be for us. And I wanted to sort of at least suggest the alienation that we might feel if we no longer had access to this incredible resource that only works because we all share in the work of learning it and maintaining it and, you know, letting it evolve together.
Well, so speaking of the connection between words and the physical body, I was wondering, I mean, we're talking on public radio, and a lot of people may not know you're also the daughter of a famous public radio couple, the hosts of People's Pharmacy. And I often think of radio as the most impermanent medium. I mean, at the end of the day, there's nothing I can point to and say physically and say, I made that. You know, it's sound waves and air. What do you think about the difference between written and spoken language?
That's such a wonderful question. One of the ideas that I was really interested in the book, and there's one character who's really interested in the philosopher Hegel, and he talks a lot about the ways, the real physicality of spoken language and the ways in which it's really a kinesthetic experience in some ways. I mean, there's the vibrations in the vocal cord of the speaker, these cords rubbing together that creates a sound that then travels through the air as waves and then enters into the body of their interlocutor and sort of rubs, oscillates their, you know, in their ear canal in just the right way.
Are you saying talking is really a kind of physical touching?
I think so. And certainly Hegel seemed to think so. And I think that's what makes sound and spoken language feel in some ways like such a more intimate experience. And I was really interested, too, in this idea that sound sort of disappears as it appears. It almost kind of there's an image in the book of Ouroboros, the sort of serpent eating its own tail. Mm-hmm. And sound is sort of just that way. It's this being that is also sort of almost non-being. It exists and then it sort of disappears all at the same time. And there's something so beautiful in that ephemerality.
Well, Elena, before I let you go, I was going to ask if you would give us one more reading. There's a little meditation, just a little short meditation about language that I love, and I wondered if you'd read it.
I would be honored.
That's called Exactitude and Evocation.
Okay, so this is taken from the journals of one of the characters whose name is Bart, and he unfortunately later succumbs in the book to word flu, and he's writing in his book about some of the reasons that language is so important to him and why he wanted to devote his life to studying it, recording it, and making it possible for other people to access it. And this is one of the things that he writes in his journal about why he loves language. Language is infinite. It can be as creative and as chillingly precise as the human mind. Bombenbrand Schrumpfleischen, e.g. a word coined per conditions distinct to the 20th century, means incendiary bomb-shrunken bodies. Less distressing, in a sense, is shita, Farsi, leftover dinner that's eaten for breakfast, or the Indonesian jayas, to bungle a joke so badly that your interlocutor feels forced to laugh. In Japanese, koi no yokan means the ineluctable feeling you have upon meeting someone for the first time that eventually the two of you will fall in love. Words compress impressions into facts cold as frozen quarters. One single word, like emergency or love, can revise a whole night, a whole life.
Elena Graydon. Her new novel is called The Word Exchange.